Many Christians today are simply stuck on the bench instead of engaging productively with others on the important kingdom issues we face.
Greg Kokol of Stand to Reason, talking about his presentation on discussing Christian convictions at this year's virtual Issues Etc. Making the Case conference.
Here's the reason. They just don't know how to maneuver comfortably in a conversation in a way that does not put them at risk, that actually makes a difference, and that looks more like diplomacy than D-Day. Well, that's what I'm going to do at the conference. I want to give a simple but powerful way to get off the bench and get into play safely and effectively.
You can watch Greg Kokol's presentation at the 2020 Virtual Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, Friday, July 24th and Saturday, July 25th. Conference registrants can watch live and on demand. Learn more and register at issuesetc.org.
I'm afraid that at this point on subjects of politics, especially if it has anything to do with morality, culture, and religion, and Donald Trump, I'm afraid you're just going to have to do careful reading.
These Puritans, and I mean that not in the sense of Christian Puritans, but in ideological Puritans, they keep trying to purify themselves to the point where they outdo one another, and in the end, they have to eat one another. They literally are killing each other.
The culture is going to turn around, it seems, more and more to go after classical Christians. In a time of soft totalitarianism, as Rod Dreher calls it, or just outright persecution.
Lutherans could say, hold on, hold your horses here. Look back at the fathers. Here, listen to what they said. And that thus they were able to show that they were not teaching something novel, not teaching something heretical.
On-demand listeners of Issues Etc. love hearing sound theology while walking the dog.
Well, I woke up yesterday morning and logged on to Twitter. Yes, that's where I get some of my news. I know I shouldn't. But there, trending at the very top on the right-hand side of my screen was the resignation of New York Times opinion columnist and editor Barry Weiss. That's big news. Then a little bit later that day, I saw a tweet from Andrew Sullivan saying he was also hanging up his hat at his publication. What is going on, and how will these defections from New York media be covered? Greetings and welcome to Issues Etc. live on this Wednesday afternoon, July the 15th. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. We're going to be talking about the resignation of the New York Times opinion columnist and editor Barry Weiss. Terry Mattingly will be our guest, founder and editor of Get Religion. Alexander DeSanctis, staff writer for National Review, joins us after that to talk about cancel culture and the destruction of monuments. And then our series on the words of Scripture continues with the word priest in the New Testament with Pastor Will Whedon, host of the daily 15-minute verse-by-verse Bible study produced by Lutheran Public Radio called The Word of the Lord Endures Forever. Joining us to discuss the resignation of Barry Weiss, Terry Mattingly, he's senior fellow at the Overby Center at the University of Mississippi. He is also author of the On Religion column for the Universal Syndicate and the book Pop Goes Religion. He's founder and editor of Get Religion. Terry, welcome back.
Glad to be here, I guess.
Well, for a long time, we've been talking about the vanishing middle in journalism, religion, and politics. What is it, and is the Barry Weiss resignation more evidence of it?
Oh, it certainly is. In fact, the heart of her letter, there's two crucial themes in her letter, one of which we may have to wait and see exactly what happens to it. But part of what she's saying is that it shouldn't be dangerous for a centrist to work in a newsroom. And when she calls herself a centrist, she of course means a centrist in the context of New York City. In most of America, she would be considered a kind of tolerant, open-minded liberal. And that's where she would fit in the spectrum. But in the context of the current New York Times newsroom, this means, to some degree, she still thinks that it's important to listen to the other half of America. And in that sense, do you remember the name Liz Spaed from a lot of our conversations?
Yes.
Yeah, the woman who was the, at the time of the Trump election and for a few months afterwards, who was the public editor of the New York Times, and then was pushed out because she kept asking the question, is the New York Times even willing to listen to the other half of America? In other words, are we willing to say that as journalists, we should somehow try to be in the middle of these conversations. And once again, I know people are tired of hearing me say it, and once again, we should treat people on both sides of these debates with accuracy, balance, and respect, the old American model of the press. Well, to some degree, that's exactly what Barry Weiss is saying got her in trouble. She was consistently condemned for criticizing what in the context of normal America would be seen as the extremes of current, I don't want to call it liberalism because it's not really liberalism, progressivism, or whatever this thing is that's happening over on that side of American life. So yes, her departure is all about the fact that the middle, being in the middle, being even to the left of the middle, is now dangerous in her newsroom. And this goes back to something we've been hearing other people writing about, which is when she said that this is a battle between the newly young, woke, kind of post-journalism journalists and the old guard of the New York Times, which she said was liberal, but was probably liberal in the old sense of the word liberal. People who've been there for a long time, and they maybe are not as concerned about media bias as I might be, but they thought that they were supposed to be doing the job of traditional journalism. And now we have people basically saying that some things are so true and so right, and we know them with such certainty. Race is the big issue right now because that's what's happening in America. But if you think they're stopping at race, you're not paying attention, specifically the race equals gender identity concept. So you had 1,000 people in the New York Times newsroom sign that letter against the Senator Cotton editorial, which was round one in this battle. Apparently, Barry Weiss, as someone working on the op-ed page as an editor, was concerned about that, among other things. And behind the scenes, this brings us to the second part of the letter that's so important. Behind the scenes, in a form of media that should be stored on a hard drive somewhere there, attention lawyers, called Slack, a program called Slack, she begins to simply, she says, to be pounded. And she refers to these things as threats, innuendos. She hints that some of it is even anti-Semitic. She eventually says and throws down a gauntlet in which she uses several legal terms in which she basically says she was harassed and was facing working in a hostile work environment. And the minute you hear words hostile work environment, and it's in a letter to the publisher of the newspaper, immediately the first thing you think, if you're thinking like a reporter, is, okay, how are journalists or lawyers going to get their hands on those Slack files? Computers store information. I assume at this point that if Barry Weiss filed a lawsuit against the New York Times for workplace discrimination, harassment, and even verbal violence and personal threats, one of the first things her lawyers would do would be subpoena the contents of the Slack files of the New York Times. All of that information is stored somewhere. And all of those alleged threats, there are digital copies of them somewhere. And at this point, you begin to think, well, who's going to cover this story about the New York Times? Who at the New York Times would cover the lawsuit? Who in the New York media would dare to cover the lawsuit? Back to Andrew Sullivan for a moment. Andrew Sullivan, of course, at this point becomes kind of the male version of J.K. Rowling, someone who has been a hero to the gay and lesbian cause for quite some time, but now is in tremendous difficulty with the newly woke because he truly believes that sex identity is rooted in biology and identity. And there's the mystery of orientation, but he believes that men are men and women are women in 99.9% 7 or 8% of the cases where there isn't DNA confusion. And that's what sex is, that it's DNA, it's biology. And you can't say that now in New York media without getting into trouble. I want to add one more layer to this before I throw it back to you and anxiously wait for your next question. This is all about the vanishing of the middle of the journalism market as well. Because when you say, how will this story be covered by the New York Times, the Washington Post, NPR, CNN, etc., what are the valid quality journalism alternatives that conservatives and traditional liberals can turn to? Old guard liberals, old tolerant, we want to be in the middle and listen to both sides liberals in journalism. Where are they supposed to work now? And this is the question you've been asking me for 2 years now, and that we addressed at the Issues Etc. conference 2 years ago. What are pastors supposed to do? What are churches supposed to do? I was in an interview the other day with some leaders from Denver Theological Seminary, where I taught briefly in the early 90s, and they said, if you really want the flip side of this, it's all the pastors in evangelical churches who are scared to talk about moral and social and political issues today in any way because half their churches are into QAnon and are into alt bulletin boards and are into truly dangerous forms of conservative media, which, needless to say, have nothing to do with traditional journalism, have nothing to do with centrism or tolerance or compromise or debates or conversations. What percentage of American conservatives have already given up on journalism? And to some degree, they're the bizarre flip side of the coin of the newly woke in the New York Times newsroom who no longer believe that you need to have fair debates and show the other side with respect. And you should just come right out and say what you think is the truth and let the pieces fall where they may. Do you see what I'm getting at there? To some degree, we don't have a middle in our media anymore. And this is just as dangerous to conservatives who have given up on traditional journalism. Now we've got the newly illiberal left giving up on traditional journalism, giving up on free speech, giving up on First Amendment liberalism. Pretty dark stuff, right?
Terry Mattingly is our guest. He's founder and editor of Get Religion. We're talking about the resignation of New York Times opinion columnist and editor Barry Weiss. When we come back, she uses the term in her resignation letter, the new orthodoxy. We'll discuss it next. You can watch and hear Mark and Molly Hemingway, Matt Walsh, Chris Roseborough, Greg Kokel, Hans Feeney, and Katie Faust at the 2020 Virtual Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference. Making the Case is Friday, July 24th and Saturday, July 25th. The $135 registration fee includes both live and on-demand viewing. For more information and to register, visit issuesetc.org or give us a call 618-223-8385.
For your next family vacation, consider Our Beach House, a charming three-bedroom vacation rental on beautiful Siesta Key. Just off Sarasota, Florida, Siesta Key Beach, consistently voted America's best, is just 100 steps away. Whether you're watching the sunset over the Gulf of Mexico or frolicking in the warm surf, you and your family will fall in love with Siesta Key. Check us out at SiestaKeyRentalGenie.com or call Virginia at 941-266-1858.
Listen to what you want, when you want. You're listening to Issues Etc. The Simply Classical curriculum for special needs moves at my child's pace and gives her exactly what she needs. So writes Amber, a homeschooling mother who has joined thousands in homes and schools teaching from this uniquely Christian classical approach to special education. Teach students with autism, learning disabilities, or Down syndrome based on ability level rather than chronological age. Use promo code LPR20 today at classicalspecialneeds.com. Classicalspecialneeds.com.
Do you know any military veterans in your church or community? Do you have a passion to support and reach them with the gospel of Jesus Christ? Then Operation Barnabas is for you. Called by Christ's love, Operation Barnabas engages, empowers, and equips LCMS faith communities to provide hope, healing, and support to military-connected persons living in their community. Operation Barnabas is a program of LCMS Ministry to the Armed Forces. Find out more at lcms.org/armedforces.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Terry Mattingly is our guest. We're talking about the resignation of New York Times opinion columnist and editor Barry Weiss. Terry is senior fellow at the Overby Center at the University of Mississippi, author of the weekly On Religion column for the Universal Syndicate, and the book Pop Goes Religion, and he's founder and editor of Get Religion. Terry, Weiss uses the term New Orthodoxy several times in that resignation letter in a pretty derogatory way. And here's one quote that I'd like you to explain to us. What rules remain at the Times are applied with extreme selectivity. If a person's ideology is in keeping with the new orthodoxy, they and their work remain unscrutinized. Everyone else lives in fear of the digital thunderdome. What is she saying there? And what about that term, new orthodoxy, sounds awfully familiar to me.
Well, it is a new orthodoxy, but to some degree, what I was just saying is it represents the death of what we would consider part of the old religion of the newsroom. And I want to take you back over two decades ago. Let me give you a statement that kind of was one of the things that led to the creation of Get Religion. In 1999, the New York Times Magazine ran a lengthy profile of an anti-abortion activist. And in the midst of this magazine piece, not a hard news piece, but a magazine piece, the author of the piece said, "It is a shared, if unspoken, premise of the world that most of us inhabit, that absolutes do not exist, and that people who claim to have found them are crazy." Now, of course, the world that most of us inhabit, when someone writes that in the pages of the New York Times Magazine, he's talking about New York. He's talking about the New York of that day. And the headline on this section of a famous article that was written about the same time, well, it was written to announce the launching of a site to compete with Get Religion called The Revealer. And the name of the piece was "Journalism is Itself a Religion." And the subhead on this particular section of the article was called "The Orthodoxy of No Orthodoxy." And what it meant was that journalists were having trouble doing coverage of religion because the religion of the newsroom was that there were no absolute truths. And thus, we don't know how to deal with people who claim that there are absolute truths. I wrote a column long ago back then and interviewed a man named William Proctor, a Harvard Law School graduate and former legal affairs reporter for the New York Daily News. And he made an interesting point. He stressed that critics who say that the New York Times is anti-religious or that it's a bastion of conservatism, he said, is wrong. You need to understand that they believe on certain issues, and that number of certain issues has expanded. That's what the Bill Keller thing about we're no longer trying to do fair, balanced coverage of religious and moral and cultural issues, but we're still being fair and balanced and accurate and old-fashioned on political coverage. They honestly believe that liberal forms of religion are right and that conservative forms of religion are wrong. So the orthodoxy of no orthodoxy in this article, press thing article by a professor at New York University, he was saying that the newsrooms are evolving to a place where you'd have to say that they really do believe that there are things that are absolutely true. And that's why it was important when BuzzFeed a number of years ago changed their newsroom style in writing, in their style book, to say, we will no longer assume that there are two sides that we need to cover when we're covering abortion, gay rights, and science, and other issues. We believe that there is, in effect, an orthodoxy. And that the old orthodoxy of no orthodoxies, journalism means that there are no absolute truths, where, you know, we just have to go out into this world and try to do our best to cover both sides of these crazy people who think there's such a thing as truth. What Barry Weiss is saying is the newsroom now fervently believes that there are truths. And they believe that they should stop pretending that on issues of sexuality and race and American politics and a lot of other things, they should stop pretending that there's no such thing as truth, that there is only an orthodoxy of no orthodoxy. They're now saying, we know what the truth is. And if you challenge it in any way, we're going to grab our keyboards, our phones, our mice, and we're going to bring you down when you violate our new orthodoxy. So that's what she's talking about. And the old liberal orthodoxy, which was the newspaper will have no orthodoxy, it will attempt to treat both sides with respect, it will seek the truth, it will try to let readers make up their own minds. We will be the part of our culture that hosts good arguments. That journalism is now dead. We now know the truth, and we are going to preach it in the op-ed pages, but also in the pages of the New York Times and in other forms of media as well. And I can't stress this too much. The New York Times sound, these people who are arguing for this, we know the truth. We believe there's an orthodoxy. We don't have to be fair to anybody else. We're going to go out there and tell people the truth and one side of the truth. We know the truth. If you don't believe the truth, you're wrong. That sounds so much like the Christians who I have spent my entire career debating, with me arguing in favor of traditional journalism. Life doesn't get much more ironic than this.
You have had decades of experience talking with journalism school graduates and students. When did this start to change at the root here, at journalism schools, where, you look, the New York Times hires only the best. They come from the best journalism schools. And this didn't start in the New York Times. I'm convinced it started in the J schools. When did you detect a change, and how did you detect a change toward this kind of journalism?
Well, the New York Times hires a lot of people who are not even from journalism schools. They're directly from Harvard and Yale and other places that are, you know, the elites of the elites, even above the J schools. I don't want listeners to hear me saying that it's like there was some idyllic past when journalism was perfect. But I think the basic values of journalism truly began to change as the people who grew up and came of age in the 60s began to enter the field in waves. And you got more open liberalism. These are the people that began having battles at the New York Times with the old school great editor Abe Rosenthal. Using a word he knew was loaded, he said, my goal is to keep the news straight. That was loaded even decades ago in the context of the New York Times newsroom. So journalism has never been perfect, but I really, and I don't say this in an attempt to be provocative or to play up to our listeners, I genuinely believe that Roe versus Wade is a turning point moment. I also believe that the hearings over Justice Bork and the ending of his public career in those hearings made the right wing want to play by whatever rules it needed to play by, to seize the court, to nail Bill Clinton in response for what happened to Bork. I think our politics just began to get more and more and more radicalized, and thus journalism became more and more radicalized. And if abortion was round one, the other battles over the sexual revolution and gay rights and a host of other things simply presented issues in the newsroom that editors struggled to get their staffs to do fair coverage. During a debate in the late 80s, we were debating journalism terminology about abortion in the newsroom I was working in that time in Denver. And there was an argument. I've put this argument in print before. And we were arguing about, you know, pro-choice, anti-abortion, or do you use pro-life, or is there a neutral term and you use instead of pro-choice? And we were arguing about all this. And I just kept saying over and over, all I'm trying to do is to argue in favor of balanced, unbiased, objective coverage on this issue. And finally, an editor said to me, Terry, the vehemence, I remember the word vehemence, I went over and wrote this quote down at my desk, the vehemence with which you keep arguing for fair and balanced coverage on this issue is evidence of your pro-life bias. And that was kind of a key moment. But in my newsroom at that time, there were plenty of editors who would not have said that. And there were plenty of editors who wanted to do accurate, balanced, fair coverage that treated both sides with respect. But, you know, I think in the 80s and the 90s, you began to see some shifts on this, but things truly, truly escalated as more and more of our politics became dominated by control of the U.S. Supreme Court. And the minute you say, we've got to control the court, what are the issues that we keep sending back to the court over and over to settle? More than any other, they are issues about religion and morality and culture, abortion, gay rights versus religious liberty, in quotes. So I think we've been watching a gradual evolution out of a stance of old liberal neutrality, the orthodoxy of no orthodoxies, and now we're seeing there is an orthodoxy. We will preach it. And if you don't like it, cancel your subscription and go somewhere else.
Terry Mattingly is our guest. We're talking about the resignation of New York Times opinion columnist and editor Barry Weiss. When we come back, we'll talk a little bit about Andrew Sullivan, and we'll discuss Rod Dreher's prescient statement made in August last year. The New York Times is the charisma magazine of the religion of anti-racism. Stay tuned. What is God calling you to do? What is the one thing you were born to do? Are you truly doing what you're called to do? The Issues Etc. Book of the Month for July is Callings for Life, God's Plan, Your Purpose. It's published by Concordia Publishing House. Their phone number, 1-800-325-3040, or learn more about Callings for Life at issuesetc.org. The Issues Etc. Book of the Month for July, Callings for Life, God's Plan, Your Purpose.
The Lutheran Church Missouri Synod celebrates and affirms life from the time of conception until natural death, and every time in between. For this reason, LCMS Life Ministry is a program singularly devoted to upholding the sanctity of human life, both in our church body and the culture at large. Life Ministry provides educational materials, hosts conferences, and works closely with allies such as Lutherans for Life. For more information, visit lcms.org/life and follow LCMS Life Ministry on Facebook.
Bahama Mama, Ocean Pacific, Paradise Island. Retreat from the heat with a shaved ice snow cone from Tropical Snow in Caseyville, Illinois. It's right across the street from Collinsville High School. Tropical Snow is open weekdays from 1 to 9 and weekends from noon to 9. Premium snow.
epic flavors, lots of love. Tropical Snow, across the street from Collinsville High School at 2134 South Morrison Avenue in Caseyville.
This is Dr. Russell Dawn, president of Concordia University Chicago, with a message for parents, grandparents, and godparents of college-bound children. Concordia Chicago is a distinctive, comprehensive university of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. We're devoted to our Lutheran confession and committed to strong academics. Please encourage your child, grandchild, or godchild to check out Concordia University Chicago at cuchicago.edu.
Smartest listeners in radio, you're listening to Issues Etc.
The Church's Music from the 20th Century. The 17th Century. The 11th Century. The 8th Century. The 4th Century. The best of the church's music from the past 2,000 years. LutheranPublicRadio.org.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking about the resignation of New York Times opinion columnist and editor Barry Weiss. Terry Mattingly of Get Religion is our guest. Journalists Mark Hemingway of Real Clear Investigations and Molly Hemingway of The Federalist will be making the case for informed Christian citizens at next week's virtual Issues Etc. Making the Case conference. The $135 registration fee includes both live and on-demand viewing. Find out more and register by giving us a call, 618-223-8385, or at issuesetc.org. The 2020 Virtual Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, Friday, July 24th and Saturday, July 25th. Terry, it was about a year ago, writing for the American Conservative, that our mutual acquaintance Rod Dreher called the New York Times the charisma magazine of the new religion of anti-racism. What was Rod talking about?
Well, Rod isn't an acquaintance of mine. Rod's been a friend for decades. I'm not sure exactly what he means, but I do know this. When he says anti-racism, he, of course, is talking about an approach to race that has grown to include many issues other than race. And when we live in an age when people are, with U.S. tax dollars, arguing that white supremacy includes things like belief in the nuclear family, belief in objective truth, belief in free speech, belief in, you know, and we get all of these things that are being attached to race. You're dealing with, I think Rod would say, a totalitarian view or a soft totalitarian view that's far bigger than actual issues of race as they would have been proclaimed by the leaders of the civil rights movement just a few decades ago. The other day, you and I were talking, and I stressed that in the issues of race, everything for us believe can begin with the statement, is racism a sin? And the obvious answer is yes. And then when you look at the systems and the institutions of our world, if you look at creation theology in the old sense of Catholic and Orthodoxy, or even then in cultural mandate theology of John Calvin, and somewhere this might be in the Two Kingdoms stuff with the Lutherans, I'm not as fluent there, but suffice it to say, we believe that all of God's creation is both glorious and fallen. It has the potential to reveal the glory of God, but it also has been touched and broken by sin and the fall of man. And I think that if you truly believe that, you don't have any trouble believing that racism has soaked into a lot of our systems and our institutions. And that we have no trouble believing that sin of various kinds has broken our institutions and our financial systems and a lot of other things. Now, how do you solve that then becomes a very complex political question. But I don't think we're actually divided here in terms of whether most Christians believe that racism is a sin. And I don't believe that if you explain it to them properly, if you can get away from the loaded term systemic racism, and you can say that our institutions and the systems of our culture are broken. They are broken by human sin. They are broken by selfishness, greed, power, and a lot of other things. I think most small O Orthodox Christians would affirm that. So what is Rod saying? Rod is saying that the New York Times has evolved into the Pravda, would be another way of saying it in addition to charisma. It's become one of the places where you find out what parts of woke doctrine have evolved into the new orthodoxy. If you want to find that out, then you read the moral, cultural, religious, and now political coverage of the New York Times. That's where you find out what all of the tanks and missiles and things in the May Day parade of the American post-left headed down the street. That's where you find out who has risen to power, what the new weapons are, what the new causes are. You've got to read the New York Times to find out who's in, who's out, and who's going to be dead soon. Dead in the kind of the mafia or cultural sense that he's dead to me.
So Andrew Sullivan, you mentioned him a moment ago, has hung it up with New York Magazine.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of people, even people who disagree with his positions on same-sex marriage and whatnot, like myself, found that profoundly sad because he was a strange hybrid of social conservative and advocacy for gay marriage and things like that. But it sounds like what Sullivan is frustrated by is this notion that the newsroom, or in his case, kind of even the world of the opinion column and commentator, is now a hostile place to him, where as of, what, maybe 15 minutes ago, he was very much at home there. He seems distressed at the fact that the ground's been pulled out from under him and the goalposts have been moved.
Yet this man used to be the editor of the late great New Republic, back when the New Republic was something that was must reading for people who wanted to take part in American debates. I would simply remind listeners that just a few years ago, you could tell something had changed when Andrew Sullivan began, in numerous occasions, to be booed at gay rights conferences. And what was he saying that was getting him booed? Do you remember?
I don't. What was it?
He was defending religious liberty, even for people with whom he disagreed. He said, I don't want to live in a culture where the government has the ability to coerce human conscience. And people were booing. They were booing him because he was liberal, not because he was conservative. He was advocating a position that for generations in American life would have been called liberalism. And it was getting him booed. And now it's getting him shoved out. So what do we do when liberals no longer believe in liberalism? And conservatives, far too many conservatives, sure as heck don't believe in liberalism. Ask David French what it's like to argue for liberalism on religious liberty issues these days. So who occupies the middle? And who wants to see journalism institutions that try to do what journalism did for generations and provide a point of discussion in the middle? Who's in favor of that now? At the moment, I find it pretty easy to get depressed trying to answer that question.
Terry Mattingly is senior fellow at the Overbee Center at the University of Mississippi, and he's author of the weekly On Religion column for the Universal Syndicate in the book Pop Goes Religion. He's founder and editor of Get Religion. Terry, thank you very much.
Glad to be here.
On the other side of the break, Alexandra DeSanctis joins us, staff writer for National Review. She has written recently a column titled In Defense of Saints and Statues. We'll talk about cancel culture and the destruction of monuments.
The COVID-19 pandemic has caused many Christians to ask about whether or not the government should be telling the church when and how to gather around our Lord's gifts. In the June-July issue of the Lutheran Witness, the Reverend Christopher Thoma takes up this question in his article titled, Executive Orders, Divine Command. To read this excellent article and more about the church's life in the midst of a pandemic, subscribe to the Lutheran Witness today at cph.org/witness. The Lutheran Witness, interpreting the contemporary world from a Lutheran perspective, cph.org/witness.
In many ways, St. Matthew Lutheran Church in Bel Air, Maryland, is just like any other Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod Church. They have worship services each Sunday and reach out to their community, but one thing they don't do is pay their electric bill. Hello, this is Rahema Kavuga, Synod Relations Manager of Lutheran Church Extension Fund. And if you want to hear what St. Matthew actually did to eliminate their electric bill, just visit interesttime.org. That's interesttime.org.
Your comprehensive source for information, teaching, and truth. You're listening to Issues Etc.
I think every man, every Christian should consider, at least, the possibility of God calling him into the holy ministry.
Issues Etc. regular guest, Dr. Carl Fekencher of Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana.
Because that's the way that God has designed for faith in Christ Jesus to be spread, for the gift of eternal life that Christ Jesus earned by his death and resurrection to be shared with people by the washing of baptism for infants and for adults, for the instruction, the proclamation of the word that happens on a nonstop basis in God's kingdom. God uses people, he uses men to be those proclaimers, to be those men who share the sacraments.
If you've ever considered becoming a pastor, contact Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Their phone number, 1-800-481-2155, 1-800-481-2155, or visit ctsfw.edu.